We're speaking with Tyler McNeil. He's a reporter for Them and Us Media, and we're here to talk about his article, When a Congregation of Evildoers Enter Troy's Grace Baptist Church. Welcome to the show, Tyler.
Thank you for having me on, Alexis.
So many people may have heard of the incident at Troy's Grace Baptist Church.
It's a lot.
Yeah, the AR-15 giveaway that happened, and then the candlelight vigil that happened the following day. But many people may not know about the fallout of that incident. Can you set the context? What happened on the first day? What happened on the second day? And what is the media focusing on?
Yeah, absolutely. So what happened on the first day, there was a protest that was planned for about 2 weeks or so. The organizers are still a little fuzzy who exactly organized it. But we do know that some of the 518 peacekeepers, which is the security force for protesters in the Capital Region, did show up there. And we know that it clearly did not go as planned. There was a tussle between protesters and the Grace Baptist Church. There was a moment in time where some of the protesters were, basically hurling insults, and the Grace Baptist Church at that time looked pretty good from a PR lens because they just stood there. So this was a disaster for the protesters. So then the next day they figured out about a second AR-15 giveaway. Rhea Drysdale, who is a Troy business leader, she's also a community activist, figured out about it. And she was like, there's only one way that we can really smooth out this image for the protesters. And that's by holding a candlelight vigil for victims of gun violence. So what happens is you have protesters outside the church at this point in time, fast forward to that night. And suddenly one protester goes up to the church, walks up the steps, and basically Lukey Forbes asks, okay, so can I go inside? And the officer's like, yes, but you have to touch the ham. And to elaborate on the context of the ham for a few seconds, the ham is this pork that is put outside the church that is intended to warn off Muslims and some Jews. So anyways, touches the ham, goes inside. They're allowed inside. So they stand there for a while in protest. And then at one point, they actually agree with the preacher who's up there, his name is Scott DiGiorgio. He was a guest of the night. He is actually at Faith Baptist Church in Petersburg in Rensselaer County. So he's up there, and he's on this, there's no better way to phrase this than a libertarian tirade, just kind of about how the government is after, you know, religious liberty and so on. And then at some point, the protesters are actually agreeing with him about government oppression. But then he dives into saying a left-wing mob is wrong. And one of the protesters there, Amy Jones, she starts laughing. And then he continues it by saying a right-wing mob is wrong. Amy Jones is apparently approached by George Kalidas. His name is Daniel George Kalidas, to be specifically. He's the pastor's son. And she's apparently asked to leave. At that point, she basically says, you know, get the beep away from me. Then there's kind of this moment where it feels like there was, you know, so much tension in the room probably at that moment. And a fight almost breaks out, but it's cooled down significantly. The main pastor of the church, John Kalidas, bans amening, but he says that everybody can stay. So he says that everybody can stay within the church, and he goes up on stage after Pastor DiGiorgio is done, and he starts talking to these protesters. It almost seemed directly at a certain point in time. He makes this plea. He tries to compare his struggles, and then he makes this plea, you know, to be saved. He says that, you know, Black lives, it's not about Black Lives Matter or Greek Lives Matter or All Lives Matter, or, and I'm not quoting this specifically, it's about being saved. So the protesters don't really like what they're hearing, because at one point he references the projects. Some of them believe that he's assuming that they're all from the projects. There's one point where he references his past. He talks about his anger towards Ottoman Turks, which were Muslims at the time, and Greek slaves. And some of them believe that he's referencing, you know, hatred towards Muslims to the crowd. They start to exit, basically directed by Lukey Forbes. So in the middle of his plea for them to embrace salvation, what happens is Adma Walker, he's the multimedia coordinator, appears to have his phone out, and there was a waiver saying that no recordings allowed, etc. George Kalidis approaches Adma, and then things start to get crazy. The security hones in on Walker, and there's a lot of insults that are flung very quickly. George Kalidis is apprehended, and then the officer kind of diffuses that situation. They end up leaving the church. There's this one solicitor. I can really call him kind of a solicitor there, because he's, you know, trying, he's saying Jesus loves you while people are leaving, etc. And at this point, you can tell that the protesters are not in a Jesus loves you mood. They leave the church, and then that's where a lot of the red meat comes in. That footage of them honing in on George Kalidis, the pastor's son, that's where all that comes from. That one moment in time, that really, that bubble of tension.
Yeah, so your article points out that when this broke on the national media scene, the footage was all the Grace Baptist Church's footage and not footage from the protesters, even though they had been told that they couldn't record. They were being recorded.
They were, yes.
The protesters were being recorded. Can you talk about how the national media has interpreted this event? What details do they include or not include?
This went into the national spotlight, and the Grace Baptist Church isn't unfamiliar with the national spotlight, as in 2014, there was the first rifle giveaway, and that came after the SAFE Act. It also was about 2 years after one of the most gruesome mass shootings to date, Sandy Hook. So there was some serious controversy going on there. Also, another thing I'd like to add before I go into talking about what happened afterwards, John Kalidis also made national news about like 20 years beforehand, when he was arrested 7 times by the Troy police, and he likes to bring that up a lot. So what happened afterwards, what we started to notice and what changed the story significantly was that conservative media started to hone in on the story, mostly by looking at the footage of protesters outside the church from the Grace Baptist Church's angle, from their footage, not some of the protesters' footage. Secondly, they honed in on what happened inside the church the second day. And this is really important to bring up the second day, because we started to notice this pattern where the first day and the second day weren't really mentioned. It wasn't mentioned that there was a second day. So we found it interesting what was going on with right-wing media? Because I think it shows the evolution of also where our media has gone since 2014, 2017. John Kalidas only spoke with right-wing media afterwards. And the video it doesn't really explain the whole situation of what was going on there. It just shows protesters breaking into kind of this rage all of a sudden. Okay. I honed on this a little bit earlier, but this is interesting that they don't specify the first and the second day. That's really interesting that occurs. They don't mention, and by they, I'm referring to a number of outlets, the Daily Wire, the Blaze, Law Enforcement Today. They don't include at all really much of what happened before, you know, that those aspects of anger came out. They don't show what happened beforehand. And that's really interesting. That's what we saw this and we were like, well, we have to do something, you know, that we have to show the whole part of this story. And the whole part of the story is that they were allowed inside the church. And there was even a point in time where the pastor said, everybody, you know, can stay. And that's not focused in on. What's also not focused in on are a lot of the moments that came before the pastor started talking. The moments where he angrily banned amening because he thought that the protesters were mocking him with amens. And I'm really not afraid to call it propaganda, because that's what it seems to be through the lens of right-wing media, is there. And we had to tell this entire story because this was a really big moment. And honestly, for much of the movement, that this was a mistake to go inside the church, but to really give this whole fleshed out version of the scene felt like it was the just thing to do.
Tyler, could you talk about the reputation of Grace Baptist Church and whether that has been included in the national story? I feel like that's a big reason why the protesters were there.
That's a really great part, and I'm so glad you mentioned that. The whole thing about the reputation of the Grace Baptist Church is that, one, when you hear Grace Baptist Church, somebody could think of probably many churches that have the same name. So you think of just kind of regular Christians if you have no context to the rest of the story. But the Grace Baptist Church is far from ordinary. So it could sound like any other church, the Grace Baptist Church, but in all reality, the Grace Baptist Church is an independent fundamentalist Baptist church, which means that they are very strict at the core of the King James Bible. And what makes this even different than most IFB churches is the fact that there are a lot of white nationalist, politically charged elements within sermons talking of, you know, bashing Jews, Catholics, politicians, other Protestants, bashing career women, you know, talking about how, you know, the COVID is overblown, talking in terms of conspiracy theories a ton. And that's what makes this a very different church than any other, especially in this area.
Can you talk about the reactions that some of the Black Lives Matter protesters had as they entered the church?
Yeah, there was one protester
He's actually part of the 518 Peacekeepers. His name is Stephen Negron. And while he was entering the church, his stomach churned. Like, he just walked up a few steps and he was like, oh. He was like, you know, Lukey, you can go inside. Lukey is, I think I've mentioned this, but he's the leader here. You can go inside. I'll just stay out here. One of the members that went into the church was a Muslim. His name's Anthony Brown Davis. And he had gloves on while he was touching the ham. He later cleaned those gloves 3 times later that night. He was so disgusted. Another one that I want to mention, this isn't entering the church, but this is leaving the church. His name's Legacy Casanova. He's a black trans man. And at the time, when he left the church, he was just, you know, later on, he couldn't stop crying. And there was even a point where Legacy just, it felt like his soul was disrupted. A lot of people that I've heard at the scene describe this as like a dark energy.
So we've been talking about the national interpretation of this event and or these events rather, especially through right-wing media lenses. But can we take a closer look at the pastor of this church, Pastor John Kalidas? What did you learn about him in your research for this article?
This was a challenge when it came to what I learned about him and, you know, what how to really put it together well without really almost humanizing all of it. So John Kalidas grew up around Philadelphia. I've heard some reports that say that he grew up in Ardmore, and then I heard another that he grew up in Bryn Mawr. So I have no confirmation about that. He grew up to Greek Orthodox parents. His mother was an immigrant. His father was kind of a full-blooded Greek, but he was in the country prior. John Kalidas ended up, he describes himself as anti-American and a communist, which, you know, for that time would have been huge. I still have no confirmation, really, within that time span of too much about what John Kalidas was like. He went to a majority Jewish school, and that was in Lower Marion High School. The one thing that I got from one of his sermons, he was talking about how some of his black friends used to throw coins at the Jewish students, and he would just kind of like, he would, you know, he would get a laugh out of that. And then he talked to his mother, and his mother, you know, said that, you know, they were, you should go get those coins. And he said this kind of as like a joke. So that was interesting. It also kind of highlights a little bit about the close relationship that he had with his mother. He was very close with his mother. And skipping ahead just a little bit, he was 21 years old, and there was this woman who, for some time, had given him these gospel tracts. And I'm not sure whether this woman was a classmate or really or teacher, or, you know, who she was. I haven't seen that information specified. But at one point, she showed him the Book of Romans. And he glanced through it. Eventually, he decided to go to her church in Hackensack, New Jersey. He was at Rutgers University at the time, court reporting school. And he went over that church, and I think it was by late November that he was just a full-on, you know, Christian fundamentalist. And it gets really interesting because what has been described by accounts of the situation is that he took a 180. He became completely immersed in conservatism at that time. And he even made a vow to God that if Ronald Reagan won, he would join the Marines. So at this time, he basically, skipping forward to 1983, there was this tragic event that occurred in which his father shot and killed his mother. And what has been described, at least within the account of one of his daughters, which was featured on a Preacher's Boy podcast, is that really shaped a lot of the way that he thought. That shaped a lot of the way that he saw things politically, you know, ideologically, how much of his life was formed. So at this point, you go to around 1987-ish, there was this guy, Richard Troll, and he's kind of talking to Kalidas, and he said, hey, there's really no independent fundamentalist Baptist churches in this area. And he was talking about the Capital Region. So Kalidas goes around, apparently on the 6-hour drive, and he sees a bunch of churches and all over the area. And then he comes to Troy, and to quote the sermon that he had on June 29th, when he got to Troy, he saw broken windows, and it reminded him of his beginning. This didn't make a lot of sense to me because Lansingburg, that area in particular, has a lot of churches. So it's more than broken windows, but apparently John Kalidas saw something in that area. So John Kalidas is there, and he starts out in the Troy Boys Social Club. About a year later, he gets his own church. It's this old hall that's on 3rd Street. Well, not old hall at that time, but it was this hall that was on 3rd Street. And he has kind of, like, he slowly grows this following, but there's a lot of turnover in the beginning. And as his daughter said, a lot of it stems from, quote-unquote, normal people didn't stay there very long. So this is one of the moments coming up that's really crucial in this story, because he talks about it quite frequently, is he ends up street preaching a lot on the streets of Troy, and he's very loud when he's doing this. So the Troy police arrest him between 1989 and 1990 7 times. And then after that, he ends up suing them unsuccessfully. So John Kalidas references that point within his sermon quite frequently. And that's really the interesting background that comes to mind on this man, that there are a lot of parts which he selectively references in terms of, you know, the beginning of the church. And from what I've heard from multiple accounts is that there's a lot of mixed messages on his beginnings. There's not a consistent story. So I had to dig and try to find all the consistent elements that stuck together within this time frame and piece them together to really figure out how John Kalidas got this way.
So your article takes this buildup of John Kalidas and Grace Baptist Church, puts it in the context of the Black Lives Matter movement and the spate of gun violence in the community, brings us to this AR-15 raffle, which drew a lot of attention. And as you said, it went horribly for the protesters and especially the way they were portrayed in the national media. To take a quote from your article about the interactions with protesters, Pastor John Kalidas would say, quote, "We could not have planned it any better," end quote. How do you interpret that statement?
That's a great question. So I saw that statement and that statement brought me back to the events that happened that day very, very clearly. Because what I got from accounts within some of the ralliers is that there was a lot of doublespeak, and there were a lot of moments where this felt like it was planned. Lukey Forbes, this wasn't in the article, but at a point he said when he entered the church, the entire back was available. The entire back row was available, and he felt like it was planned. He felt that way. Now, whether to say it was or not, that's, I can't confirm that. But what I can say is that it's undoubted that this was a certain victory for the church's message. Absolutely. Of that these are the savages, quote unquote savages. And here's us, freedom loving people that are just peaceful in our own church. And there wasn't a lot of light shed on anything else.
Can we put it in the larger context of the Black Lives Matter movement? The right-wing media took this footage and turned it into, as your article says, quote, a one-size-fits-all example of left-wing mayhem. What did you mean by that?
So by left-wing mayhem, you'll see quite frequently within the right-wing media that they are very selective in how they portray Black Lives Matter protesters. And by that, they like to show barbaric behavior. They like to show what they, consider rageful reactions. They like to portray the Black Lives Matter protesters as just kind of naive and uncivilized, uncouth, and just almost like almost as if they are inferior in every way, and these are just peace-loving Americans. So and that's what I was saying before. This is a propaganda victory because they got the footage that they needed to show that. And as I told you, the footage does not tell the full story, but it does enough, at least within right-wing media, to show the story they want.
So this event happened just over 3 weeks ago. Your article came out just a couple of days ago. Where do the Black Lives Matter organizers stand at this point when it comes to the Grace Baptist Church?
Very mixed. It's very mixed right now. Some organizers are saying, be very careful. Try to plan everything super cautiously because, you know, they're smarter than we thought. Some are still angry. Some are very angry and they want to basically, this wouldn't be the right word, but strike back, so to speak. And, you know, they still want to take this church down. I'll admit I haven't heard many accounts of just purely, you know, let's give up. But it certainly is something that's still on a lot of protesters' minds.
Is there anything about the fallout of this AR-15 giveaway that we haven't discussed that you want to mention, Tyler?
Yeah, so the really interesting thing here is that a lot of it wasn't about the AR-15 towards the end of it. Even though that there was a vigil held for gun violence, everything that was really honed in on wasn't so much about the AR-15 itself. It was mostly about the church's rhetoric, about a lot of the racist and the sexist rhetoric that went on. And I think this one stands out significantly from other previous giveaways that the church has had, because beforehand, it was usually about the rifle. It wasn't as much about how this church sends out its message. And the other thing that I really like to I'd like to elaborate on is that I was reading the Washington Times recently, and they reportedly say that they now have a larger congregation because of this. So there are elements that are still at play that are actually bringing people still into this church. And one final thing that I think is really important here is that there was a petition that was put out at the time. It has now about 75 signatures, but at this event, there were numerous residents who were very upset with the Grace Baptist Church being in their neighborhood and sending the messages that it has sent. And that's not to say that there weren't a ton of residents there that were also upset at the chaos that occurred the previous day, Sunday. But it's to say that there is a large community element here at play, that protesters are now, some protesters like Lukey Forbes are now focusing on taking that and trying to push forward with some sort of way to get the Grace Baptist Church out of the Lansingburg community.
We've been speaking with Tyler McNeil. He's a reporter for Them and Us Media. We were talking about his article, "When a Congregation of Evildoers Enter Troy's Grace Baptist Church." It was published on July 19th, 2020. If you want to read the full article, it goes into a lot more detail about the Grace Baptist Church than we were able to discuss here. Head on over to themandusmedia.com. Tyler, thank you for joining me today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
It was a pleasure.